your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
And that's me. Good morning, everybody. The 25th of September, the first month of 2009. September? Who said that? Who said that? January, February? As you can see, I check the calendar all the time before I come into work. Okay, so the 25th of January. I was just wishing that the decade didn't pass by quite so quickly. We're in 2009, and January is almost over. Well, here at the Wake Up Call, we're going to be talking about what is going on in 2009, I guess sort of what 2008 is moving into as we talk about economics, the policy, the new economics with the new administration with our guest today, Professor David C. Smith. David, how are you?
Good. How are you, Rick?
I'm doing well, except apparently my brain is either way ahead or way behind. And I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who would agree with that. A special thanks to the folks at Levinson's 94.7 for tuning in today. And let's thank the Blue Ridge Graphics folks. They're always with us here on the Wake Up Call. You can find them at Meade Avenue and East High Street in Charlottesville, providing custom T-shirts and professional sportswear for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and at brgtshirts.com. They do some nice promotional items. Check them out. All right, David C. Smith with us today. He's from the UVA McIntyre School of Commerce. Spent 5 years at the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, D.C. as a staff economist in the early 2000 decade, 2000 to 2005. David, exactly what does a staff economist do?
Well, it's a cog in a very a big and I would say well-oiled machine. There's 250 PhD economists roughly that work at the Federal Reserve Board in Washington. There are other economists that work out at the Federal Reserve banks around the U.S. And we each have our own little job to plug in to the sort of a central thought process that informs the Board of Governors, including the chairman of that board, who is now Ben Bernanke. Advising them on all aspects of the economy.
And now you have moved down to your much better job here at the University of Virginia in our lovely but cold Charlottesville.
That's right. We love Charlottesville.
All right. Let's jump right into things. By the way, phone number today, 979-0919-1877-WNRN-ROCKS. That's toll-free for folks a little further out. Just a simple, probably a 2 or 3 word answer to this question. What is the current state of our financial system?
Current state is better than it was in the fall, but still ailing, hurting, hopefully a hurting that's getting better, recovery.
So is this because people are getting a little more faith in what's going on and some of the changes that have been made? Is this because we've hit the bottom and there's nowhere to go but up?
Well, I don't think it's – I wouldn't answer in the affirmative to either of those. I think one thing is that the government intervention last fall probably helped to mitigate some of the dangers of having a complete financial meltdown. What the government's done since then, you know, we could debate about. I think some things have been good, lots of things have been bad, or at least inconsistent. So I don't think it's restored necessarily folks' confidence in the financial markets by itself. I would love to think we've hit the bottom. I think it's too early to tell whether we have hit the bottom. There's still some other shoes that could drop between now and, say, the middle of the year.
All right. So you're saying that things look better now, but it's still a seesaw.
That's right. So there's a couple things that look better. First, the overnight lending markets, what banks lend to each other and what other institutions require on very liquid financing. Those markets, which were looking like they are coming unraveled back in October, November even, they're looking in much better shape. So that if those markets didn't come back and begin to function again, I think we'd be in a much better, worse situation than we are right now. Another positive sign is that mortgage rates for qualifying buyers, that means somebody who's got really good credit and probably a lot of equity in their house or not buying a very expensive house, mortgage rates are very low, and companies are offering mortgages, finance companies and banks, both for refinancing purposes and new housing. Those are the good signs. But there's still a lot of a lot of other dimensions where the financial markets still are pretty much shut down.
Well, and that's, I guess, I'll admit early on that this entire topic is far out of my league of understanding, and all I generally do is, you know, read the paper, read the internet articles, and try and understand them, and then invite guests like yourself on to pretend that when I go home after the hour that I can have a conversation with someone else and repeat an interesting part of the conversation from you. But is it not true that since this has all begun and since the general lending rate has declined and a lot of the effort has been made by our system to speed things up, to make things better with the lending, that hasn't been passed down? There has been no true trickle-down theory to make it easier for the general public to buy a car, buy a house, that the banks have been keeping this money.
That's right. So, again, I think if we look for qualified buyers in the mortgage market and the housing market, there is more lending. Auto companies are also beginning to offer attractive financing for folks who are interested in buying a new car. But there's two things that are going on here that are weighing down on the market or any sort of trickle-down benefit. The first is these banks are really scared. Some financial institutions have disappeared. Others, big titans that we thought were really healthy, are being split up. Still others have been merged into other banks. And we're not out of the woods as far as that goes. And I think what that means for any bank that wants to try to survive is they're going to, unfortunately, take the money they're getting from the government and just hold on to it, sort of fall on the ball, as it were. The other thing that's going on is because of the big slowdown in the economy, consumers, even if they wanted a loan, consumers, even if banks were willing to lend to them, just aren't interested in buying things that require financing right now. It seems that we all have enough new autos for a little while. Nobody's that interested in buying a new house if they can't sell their old house. And so it's not all just the banks not lending. It's partly on the demand side from consumers and from businesses as we move through this slowdown in the economy.
We talk about the banks lending money, receiving money. Are the banks that are left better? Because it seems to me that some of the banks, Wachovia, was purchased or taken over or whatever the proper jargon term is. And so now it's part of a much larger bank, and we can list dozens. Are these larger banks better to the public, better for themselves, better for the government?
It's not clear. And we can talk about government actions separately from this if you want to, but part of the problem has been is the government, the Bush administration, through the end of its term, really played things inconsistently, didn't seem to have a plan in place to not only sort of save the banks to the extent that they needed capital to protect depositors or investors, but also they didn't have an idea of where they were going and why what would it take to have a healthy financial system going forward. They seem to be lost on that, and I think they made a lot of unwise decisions that ends up with making the the answer to your question, Rick, very unclear, because I don't, it's not clear to me that these financial institutions, many of them that have gotten help, are any healthier. I think, I mean, there, I think Wachovia has been taken over by a pretty, as far as we can tell right now, a pretty good bank, Wells Fargo. But even the idea, is it better to have bigger banks or smaller banks? The government seems schizophrenic on that. On the one hand, they're pushing to have Citigroup break up into smaller pieces, saying there's no, we shouldn't have a financial supermarket. I kind of tend to agree with that. On the other hand, they pretty much forced Bank of America, you know, figuratively at gunpoint, to take over Merrill Lynch, and they've been encouraging other mergers as well. Oftentimes, you could argue that these are mergers between two bad banks, and two bad banks together don't make one good bank.
Professor David C. Smith here from the University of Virginia's McIntyre School of Commerce. We're going to talk about new administration economics and how the system is going today. Dial us up if you have a question, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Send us an instant message, WNRN Studio, and I'll do my best to read that. You mentioned Merrill Lynch and Bank of America. My understanding is that just before the new year, Merrill Lynch gave millions of dollars in bonus money to some of their top executives, because at the start of 2009, Bank of America and the government would have a greater control over what was going on. Is that true?
Yes.
And how do they get away with that?
Well, I think that's probably really, really eating away at Bank of America's CEO, Kenneth Lewis, right now, because he felt like last fall, after doing what he thought was good due diligence, just looking at Merrill Lynch and deciding whether or not this is an institution that was too toxic to touch or something that would be worthwhile taking in under their wings, he became pretty comfortable with the quality of the institution, and he relied a lot on the CEO, the newly appointed CEO of Merrill Lynch, a guy named John Thain, as kind of an honest arbiter. And as it turns out, Thain, you know, his mask was torn off, or either that, or he sort of, you know, drank some sort of weird mix that made him turn into something that was a lot more unpleasant, and it included doing all sorts of things. One of which is what you admitted, trying to push for millions of bonuses to pay out to his old Merrill Lynch employees before the government, before the Bank of America could say anything. And this was done unbeknownst to Bank of America. And really, the big kicker was there were substantial losses on the order of $15 billion revealed sort of as a Christmas surprise to Bank of America in Merrill Lynch without Bank of America having any prior knowledge, and John Thain, the CEO, rather than going to Kenneth Lewis man-to-man and discussing where these losses came from and why, Thain took off for Vail to his house on the sunny sides of Vail ski slopes, and Lewis found out through other sources about these losses. So needless to say, the end result was this week John Thain was asked to leave his post in the combined company. This is something that we have to deal with, and wouldn't be completely surprised if we saw some other strange things unfold, get uncovered between now and or throughout the new year. I mean, nothing surprises me these days, and I think that's why there continues to be an incredibly cautious feeling out in the markets when we constantly are surprised by new things. Just as we believe that we've uncovered all the bad things, gotten all the bugs out from under the rocks, something else comes along to surprise us again.
And we have a call here. Again, you don't have to come on air if you don't choose to. This person has given an anonymous note to Sean. Sean's out producing the show today. Okay. Somebody from Fluvanna wants to know, isn't all this painfully necessary? The spending, all the money that's being put forth around to the financial industry.
Yes. I think requiring the government to get involved in this current crisis, requiring them to spend what seems like an incredibly large amount of money is necessary. The problem for us is not that whether or not they need to spend the money, it's what they do with that money and how they direct things and manage things going forward. And it's the management and the direction that worries me, not the amount spent so much.
Explain that a little more, the direction.
Well, I think coming back to what you asked earlier, Rick, what we want going forward are healthy banks and healthy markets that aren't going to fall prey to a large and painful downturn or crisis that we've seen this time. And the way to do that is to fix the things that were wrong and change the institutions, the way individuals in these institutions work and think, how they're compensated, what their incentives are, so that they don't get themselves into this again. And I think the government has decided to turn a blind eye to those sort of changes. Rather, they'd just as soon as prop these companies up and let them continue the same old way that they were behaving before. And I think that's a mistake. And I'm happy to give you a couple examples of that.
Fire away.
Well, I think, you know, back in September or October when the government was first talking about getting involved with what became termed the bailout plan, financial bailout plan, there was lots of thinking in advance about how best to clean up the system, how best to get the bad assets off their balance sheets and move them forward, and included thinking about changing management, about perhaps requiring some of the investors to take losses, investors who sort of were gaining and rewarding the most from sort of this risky behavior, having them take the losses so that they, you know, anybody who wants to engage in the risky behavior in the future knows that there's some chance that there's a loss. And, there's even thoughts about, you know, requiring some financial institutions to simply go out of business and to be broken up. Not only is this sort of thinking important because that you want to find the lowest cost way of solving the problems, it's also a good way to think about how you incent financial institutions in the future, because if a financial institution thinks if they make decisions that are too risky and they lose the bet that they're out of business, chances are they're going to think more in advance about whether or not to take those risks. What we've seen instead is the government's worked very hard to put the money in, prop up the institutions, and the message that sends to these two investors and to managers in these companies is that, hey, let's make big bets. If we win, great, everybody's happy. If we lose, the government and the taxpayers there to bail us out, and there aren't really any other consequences. We can keep our jobs. It's lovely, fun, and boy, you know, wouldn't it be great if we all had those kind of deals?
Yeah, that would be nice to know that you could, as people know, I love to go to Vegas, and if I knew that I could just bet my money and only either come home with what I left or come home with winnings, that kind of takes some of the fun out of it, I think,
right.
Although a little better for my pocketbook. 11:19 here on the wake-up call, Professor David C. Smith here from University's McIntyre School of Commerce, also spent 5 years at the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, D.C., I got a caller from Richmond. Hang on just a second. Other line is open, 979-0919. Let me give you the weather for the day. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Mostly cloudy today, highs 30 to 35. Cloudy with a chance of flurries tonight, lows 25 to 30. Clouds tomorrow, highs 35 to 40. A little warmer in Richmond and Lynchburg. Right now, there's a cloud or two in the sky. In the valley, it's 26, 25 in Lynchburg, 28 in Richmond, 23 here in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And let's thank 45fix.com. If you have a project but not the time, there's a simple way to find a contractor. From kitchen and bathroom remodeling, house painting, to decks and siding, it's 45fix.com. Immediate, no obligation estimates available anytime. That's the number 4 and the number 5 and the word fix.com. And WNRN reminds you that open registration for all UVA intramural and recreation programs is underway now online or at the IM Rec Sports Business office in the Aquatic and Fitness Center. You can sign up for dance, tennis, swimming, martial arts, running and racing, and intramural sports leagues. Online info and registration forms are at virginia.edu/IMS, or you can call the NRN studio line after we're done. All right, let's see. I got my man Doug from Richmond. Hey, Doug.
Hey, how you doing?
Thanks for hanging tight. All right, what you got?
Hey, man, I think we're turning into a third world country.
And why do you say that?
I mean, there's people losing jobs left and right all over the country. Plants are shutting down. There's big layoffs, unemployments, things like that. I'm talking to people out of state in the same way. And Richmond stands to lose a lot of jobs. And I know my sales, I'm a wildfowl carver, and it's not something that people have to have. Art is not something that people have to have, but my sales have been down so low. And I had a good buyer, and he's not doing well either. But anyway, I just think things are going downhill. Unless this guy, this new president we got, unless he can do something to get the economy stimulated, I think we're going to be in big trouble here in the next year or two.
All right, man. Well, thanks for the call. I'm going to let Professor Smith reply to that, all right?
Yeah, thanks, Doug. No, there's no doubt that we're in a painful situation and probably just at the beginning of a painful situation from the viewpoint of job losses, from a general slowdown in the economy. I anticipate that it's not going to end soon. Maybe we'll start to see some fresher light towards the end of 2009. But I don't want you to get too much in despair because we've gone through downturns before, and U.S. is a resilient economy. We have great workers in our economy, creative, innovative, hardworking folks. And at the end of the day, as long as we have that, sooner or later things will turn around.
All right, you can call in and ask your question or make your comment. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS, Professor Smith from the UVA McIntyre School here in town, or WNRN Studio with your instant message, which is where we got our last question. Professor, with the layoffs and foreclosures, how does the economy recover?
So that's a great question, and I don't even know if I'm going to answer it to the satisfaction of the person who sent the message in. The one thing we need to keep in mind is that our economy, especially towards the mid-2000s, 2005, 2006, was really getting overheated. And, of course, we don't notice that when we're there because we love it. It's nice for us. It's everybody's spending money and everybody's making money. Everybody can get easy loans and it's really easy to buy a house. The consequence of it is a little bit like going to a New Year's Eve party and having a lot of fun, drinking a little bit too much and not really realizing it until you wake up the next morning. What part of the issue we need to do now is we need to get over the hangover. And in the economic standpoint, that means there's really probably there was so much going on in terms of buying and manufacturing that we have too much capacity for probably what the economy can sustain in the long run. And unfortunately, that means that we're going to have to close stores, close restaurants. There will be manufacturers that will have to reduce the amount that they're manufacturing, and that will have short-term consequences in terms of perhaps or probably reducing their workforce. Once you get that part cleared out, though, there are still healthy parts of the economy. And also, as consumers feel like their own balance sheets, their own the amount of that they owe in terms of debt relative to how much money they're making, when they get to a position where they feel more comfortable with it, what they can spend in the future, they'll start spending again. And sort of a chicken and egg thing. You need consumers spending money to get retailers to sell things. And when retailers start selling things, manufacturers start manufacturing things again. It's a little bit simplistic view of the world, but that's kind of how it works. And, you know, there'll be certain parts of the economy that'll come back first. Right now, a very healthy sector is the energy sector. Even though we have lower oil prices and lower natural gas prices, the energy sector really took a big beating in the early 2000s. I'm thinking about not so much as the oil companies, but as power plants and power companies here in the U.S. and companies that are associated with extracting natural gas and bringing it to market. All these guys really struggled in the early 2000s. They already got their balance sheets cleaned up, and they're looking very, very healthy for the future. So we'll see recovery in areas like that first, and then eventually this will spread to the entire economy.
All right. One question leading to my next question. Out of the original $700 billion, is that what the original money was?
That's right.
All right. And we've put forth half of that?
I think so, roughly. I think half of it's committed. Nearly $200 billion of it's already been spent. It's already been doled out to financial institutions, from the largest financial institutions in the country to medium and smaller size institutions. But I think an additional $150 has been committed. So we're looking at half of that already being.
All right. And my understanding is that almost all of that has been for financial or manufacturing.
That's right.
Okay. So with the United States having turned into a mostly service country, our manufacturing has been shipped out to other countries. The financial part is the industry that has mostly brought forth the economic situation that we're in. But the service industry is where so many people have their jobs. Has there been any discussion about what to do with the service industry, with giving money out or assisting in some way?
Well, the fact that I haven't heard anything, and that may in part be due to the fact that the service industry is much more dispersed. So we think of the service industry includes the stores that sell items for us, restaurants that produce food for us, mechanics that work on our cars. And as a group, they don't have quite much political clout, I'd say, as the manufacturing industry, which has been concentrated and, as Rick, you just said, has been shrinking for years. Those remaining manufacturing constituents, you know, have a loud voice. Yes. So I'd say also the service industry, for instance, in healthcare is another dimension that is pretty healthy as it goes, and also was looking to get substantial government support, not because they're failing, but because folks want to fix our healthcare crisis, and that's probably good for the healthcare sector, because that probably means more government money coming in to help them out.
All right, 11:29 here in the wake-up call with Professor David C. Smith from UVA's McIntyre School, also having spent 5 years as a staff economist at the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, D.C. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. And we got Gary from Albemarle. Good morning, Gary.
Hey, Rick. Great program. Glad you had this guest on. He sounds so young that it's hard to believe he has 5 years' experience with the Federal Reserve.
He looks young, too.
I have two questions, and I'll just hang up and listen. Number one, why should I, my spouse, and my kids, who have been fiscally careful, don't have credit card debts, don't have car payments, paid off a mortgage early, you know, is pretty well set, not rich, but have been careful. Why should we be involved in our taxes having to bail out others, bankers, or people who were stupid enough to get in over their heads on their home loans? Why should we have to bail them out? That's question number one. Question number two is, does the professor see any potential criminal indictments coming down the road for Democrats and some Republicans in the previous Congress who voted for this first fat bailout package? And I'm thinking of this because of the cozy relationship a lot of these elected officials have with the people that finance them, mainly bankers and other financial institutions. So I'd just hang up and listen.
Oh, I hear you, Gary. I'm sensitive to the question you ask. I think it really comes back to the frustration that folks that have been careful feel when they see these amounts of money going to industries in which the managers, the captains of these industries have not been careful. And moreover, it just perverts incentives further because it's not teaching them that they should have been, like you have and your family's been, careful in how they spend their money. So I don't have a great question to answer to that question, except to say there, you know, last fall, it seemed like the stupidity of the financial institutions were getting us all into trouble because it was sort of shutting down, freezing up the markets. And to the extent that, unfortunately, helping those that were stupid out unfreezes those markets, there is some benefit to us all for doing that, from doing that. But I think, you know, now the government's going beyond that, and, you know, there's always this joke about, you know, once somebody gets some money, everybody's got their hand out, and we see that in play. It's not the fiscally responsible people that have their hand out necessarily, although some people have been hurt in very unfortunate ways, blindsided in when they were careful by this, but certainly not, like I said, the captains of these industries, the financial industry, and much, and in particular, the auto sector. Criminal indictments, well, perhaps no, there could be criminal indictments coming along, depending on what we uncover, you know, what more things crawling under rocks we find. Certainly, we already see evidence of there being connections between congressmen and their local financial institutions and trying to steer money towards them. There are a couple articles in the Wall Street Journal this week. Representative Barney Frank appears to have gotten personally involved in making sure one of his local favorite financial institutions got money. There are two Illinois congressmen who tried to influence regulators and try to stop them from shutting down a smaller bank that was in trouble. And, you know, there was all sorts of people with their fingers in the pie on both sides of the aisle in these institutions, including Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, you know, before this crisis ever started, that, you know, certainly, if not created the crisis, made it a lot worse. So let's just wait and see. The best thing, if there's no criminal indictments, if we think they've acted irresponsibly, we should vote them out of office.
All right. We got Jay from Charlottesville. Hey, Jay.
Professor Smith.
Hi, Jay.
A question about inflation. With all the spending that the government's doing to bail everybody out, do we anticipate inflation hitting us, and if so, when?
Okay, good question, Jay. Or Jay may actually even be the Jay that's my neighbor, Jay. I'm not sure. It sounds like it. Well, I think, ironically, for the short run, inflation's not a concern. The slowdown in the economy has been so abrupt. What right now we're worried about is deflation. Now, I think the concerns that the government, including my former employer, the Federal Reserve, have, their worries about deflation may be a little bit overblown. We've only had one quarter, maybe two quarters of CPI data to show that prices are actually falling. But I think as long as we're in a real big slowdown in the economy, the spending that's going on and the floodgates the Federal Reserve has opened up into the market actually won't lead to inflation. What we do need to worry about is sort of the medium to long term, and that's when the economy does start coming back, and I believe it will come back. We do have a lot of excess demand that's been created by the government out there, plus a lot of excess liquidity that's been put out by the Federal Reserve. And if we don't do something at that time or to mitigate that, to sop up the liquidity, to get our spending under control, then inflation can be a really big concern. And the fear is that it will start up and really get going before we even know it's there. And I believe, you know, I do have a bias, but I do believe the Federal Reserve works very hard to try to stay on top of this. They're not interested in flooding the market with liquidity, say for political reasons, like you would see back in the early 70s. They really want to reverse what they're doing now as soon as possible, but they're not going to do that before they see a sign that the economy is beginning to recover.
Great. Thank you so much.
All right, Jay, thanks for the question. 979-0919, if you want to call up and ask your question or make your comment. 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS, that's toll-free. WNRN Studio is the instant message board. 1136 here with Professor David C. Smith from UVA's McIntyre School, also with a background of 5 years at the Federal Reserve Board. And there goes the phone line right now. David, let me ask you real quick. Gary called in and obviously made his viewpoint known about helping out people who made bad decisions. I'm curious, it seems like everybody, and that's obviously somewhat of an exaggeration, did quite well while the economy was roaring along. From others who made bad decisions. Didn't matter whether you personally were making a good decision or a bad decision. Your neighbor, the person you didn't know who lived across the country, helped you whether you were up or down. And so why do we change our viewpoint now if the person across the country or your neighbor is also having an effect on your current situation?
Well, tell me the question one more time, Rick.
Well, it just seems like and I'll make it personal. I did well in 2005 based on the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it had nothing. Maybe I made good decisions. And now I'm still making good decisions, but my personal financial situation is crummy. So why can't the government help me? Because I had nothing to do with my current situation because I only made good decisions. But it's the people over there who put me in this spot.
I think if it was easy for us and for the government to distinguish between those who made good decisions and failed by accident and therefore, you know, quite honestly are deserving of some help, especially if they're down and not able to pick themselves up again, distinguish between those types and those that were making the stupid decisions and now are claiming they were innocent. It's very hard to distinguish between the two. And so ever trying to separate those is a tough challenge. And actually, I think that boils down directly to sort of trying to help out folks who have a mortgage that they can't afford right now because they bought a house that was too expensive given the income they had, but they had some attractive, you know, fad loan from their bank back in 2004. Or somebody who's just lost their job suddenly because of the downturn and can't afford their mortgages. Distinguish between those folks who you'd like to help out and those who were, you know, essentially exploiting the easy lending markets to buy and flip houses, but now come up with stories to make them sound like they're the poor people getting stuck. It's very hard to distinguish between those two, and it puts the government in a bind. They want to do what's right, and oftentimes they're going to throw money at both groups, and other times they're going to not give money to either groups. And so it's really hard to get at that.
11:39 on the wake up call here with Professor David C. Smith. Follow up, ask your question. 979-0919 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, a retired fire captain spent his career preaching fire safety, but when a fire broke out in his own house, the fire detector couldn't save him. and one expert says he knows why. Read it in The Hook. Due to the economic downturn, UVA's Jefferson Scholars Foundation will be offering fewer scholarships this year, but continuing to build its new $21 million facility. How about that? And the culture calendar tells you where to be and when. Don't miss out. The Hook. Take one every week. Read, recycle, repeat. And let's thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for being with us today. If it's keeping warm and having fun in the outdoors this winter, Blue Ridge has the gear for you. Whether your outdoor adventure is winter running, hiking, climbing, or snowshoeing, you'll find Blue Ridge Mountain Sports in the Barracks Road Shopping Center here in Charlottesville, the Mountain Inn at Wintergreen, or at brms.com. And not that you would, but don't go anywhere, because the man, Drew Thompson, just showed up for Les Temps Purdue. He'll be on at noon. If French isn't your thing here at NRN, that means the time's gone by. And it's also 80s and 90s alternative. Tune in for it next. Les Temps Purdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music. David, I think we were talking a little bit about who deserves it and who doesn't deserve a problem. One of the instant message questions I got was, who supports the laid off folks? And where do they go when their homes are taken away? Isn't that just more of a drain on the problems that we're having now?
Yes, it can be certainly. It's in everybody's interest to have everybody working and have everybody happy and living in their house and not being thrown out on the street. So there are actually mechanisms in place. If you look at one big, let's say, I don't believe that the economic downturn that we're going to see coming up is going to be anything like the Great Depression. I think remains to be seen, but I think a few people have been overselling the magnitude of the potential slowdown. But one big difference, even if we do have a big slowdown, that what we have today that we didn't have in the 1930s is unemployment insurance, benefits for unemployed workers, benefits that go to individuals, citizens of this country, including Social Security, healthcare benefits, and so forth, that are there to protect them during downturns. Now, the systems aren't perfect. In particular, there are a lot of people who fall through the cracks for healthcare. But we do have what we call a social safety net in place that wasn't in place in the 30s to help as much as we can for those who have become unfortunate, lost their jobs, and need some extra assistance.
Here's a comment from Alan here in Charlottesville. His idea is, if everyone buys something extra once a month, say on the same day of the month as their birthday, wouldn't this stimulate the economy?
It's a good idea, Alan. I'm not sure if that would do the trick. One thing I think we need to be careful about, and this is something that I think the government and a lot of commentators fall prey to too, one thing we don't want to do is we don't want to get out of this economic downturn by creating the mess we got into in the first place. And some of that mess was created by, you know, easy lending, buying for the sake of buying, and propping up the economy that way, and you know, getting what some would term a bubble economy. We all felt good during the bubble economy, but then we have a hangover afterwards. The cure for sometimes the cure for a hangover is to drink a little bit more, but I think when you've been drinking too much for too long, that's not the good cure, and I think we have to be careful about how we stimulate the economy.
All right, David C. Smith here. Dial us up. Ask your question again. A lot of people just passing the questions along through Sean. That works for us today. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Even gotten a few questions on the internet. WNRN Studio is the instant message address. David, when you were here the first time, we talked a lot about the big three and what was going on with the automakers. And as we talk about money being passed around to try and help financial and, in this case, manufacturing part of our economy, the last time people were almost making fun of Detroit because these CEOs of Chrysler, Ford, General Motors showed up on their private jets to get there. But now it seems like in that time period that the emphasis has been put on the worker, not on the CEO, and how the manufacturing from the cars is affecting the overall economy. Have people started to have somewhat of sympathy now for what's going on in Detroit and almost sort of swung around to be more positive in the possibility of helping them with bailout money?
I don't have any evidence that people, at least folks here in Virginia, my peers, folks in this, certainly in the Southeast, I don't have any sense that they're any more sympathetic. I think the automakers changed their story a little bit, made it a little bit more sophisticated, and tried to argue, and this is what the Bush administration argued as well, that if we let these guys go under or go bankrupt, then the ripple effects are going to be so immense during this tense slowdown that it would just be devastating for the economy. I think they just changed their story. I don't buy that story in the least bit.
All right. Call up, ask your question of Professor David C. Smith here in the studio today, 979-0919. David, we've used the word stimulus package several times during the hour so far. And I realize this isn't your specialty, but it seems to me, for the people that I've talked to about this, that everyone's like, oh, doesn't that mean I get another check from the government? How much am I getting this time? Is that part of this stimulus package? Because all I've heard is stimulus package equals where we'll give the money to the government or this industry or that industry, but I haven't heard anything about a check in my mailbox.
Right. So I think what people are terming the stimulus package, the package that I think that President Obama now is working with both the Senate and the House on, has two components. It has a spending component and has a tax component. The two together estimated to be or cost at least $800 billion. And I think roughly, depending on whether it's the Senate or the House version, the split between spending and tax incentives is about 50-50. But the tax plan includes at least, I don't know about any sort of direct paychecks back to us, but it is one piece that's included, I think it was part of President Obama's policy stance prior to the election, was to give a $500 per worker payroll tax holiday, meaning that all of us would be paying $500 less in payroll taxes this year as one stimulus idea. So that's sort of the same gig there.
How does that help me, though?
Well, I think the idea is that...
Am I going to notice that anywhere? I mean, it's kind of like if you get a raise on your paycheck. Hey, we're going to give you a $1,000 raise this year. And then when you get your check, you're like, what the heck? What is that, $7?
Right. I think
by the time you split it over 52 weeks and the government gets their cut, it looks like nothing.
Sure. And I think it's sort of like a Christmas bonus type thing. Again, this isn't my area of expertise, but the idea is that you give $500 to everybody. What do you have, 300 or 400 million people? Or I don't know how many taxpayers we have how many workers we have that would get that tax credit, but that it would add up. I think that the basic issue is, though, in these times, are we going to take, you know, as individuals, as consumers, as household folks who have to run a household, are we going to take that $500 and apply it to paying down our debt? I think that's probably what I would do. Or are we going to spend it? And if we apply it to paying down our debt, that's actually good in the short, and that's good for us because that's helping getting our balance sheets in order. But in the short run, it doesn't help to stimulate the economy. Now, that's not the only tax incentive. I think there's a host of other tax incentives, both for folks like us, tax breaks at the individual level, and I think there's also business tax breaks that are being considered. And perhaps as unseemly as it sounds to many folks, it might be better to provide incentives for companies to start spending, investing money, some of their own money, especially healthier companies. And give them incentives by requiring that they pay less taxes into the into the government coffers.
Here's another instant message question about the difference between what happened last year in the Bush administration and what's going to happen with the Obama administration in terms of the economic goals.
That's the question?
Yeah.
What is the difference?
What are the differences?
Well, the whole strategy of the Bush administration was to do anything they could, give anybody that asked for it money just so that they wouldn't later be accused of letting somebody go bankrupt on the end of their watch. They obviously didn't have any long-term plan beyond the bailout plan from last fall. I think they're solely relying on, you know, the fact, knowing that they were leaving office, you know, January 20th, and that it was going to be President Obama's problem. I don't see, I think if it were, say, a Republican president and now instead of President Obama, I don't know whether there would be a big difference. I know that, for instance, Congress on both sides of the aisle wants a stimulus package. They want the economy going again, partly for their own self-interested reasons. They want to get elected again, and if that means spending taxpayer money to do it, then so be it. So there may have been the Republican administration may emphasize tax cuts more than new spending programs, but I think the differences would be at the margin.
All right, looks like we got another call, and it's Ed from Charlottesville. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, and good morning, Professor.
Good morning, Ed.
My question is, in an ideal world, free markets are self-regulating or somewhat self-regulating, but we've clearly seen that companies and individuals leading those companies don't always act in the interest of the collective good, if you will, or even necessarily in the interest of their shareholders. So regulation is clearly coming, and my question is, what do you think is needed, and what are the dangers if we go too far?
Well, that's a great question. Tough to answer it along all dimensions, but you know, I think one thing we had to do is we had to distinguish between what parts of the downturn in the economy were created by market failures, and I agree with you that some of these have been created by market failures, and what parts of the downturn and the pain we're feeling now are just the result of natural ups and downs in the economy. And if it's a market failure, then I think there is a role for government to be there. Now, what is the best way the government can regulate? In my opinion, it's one, to require as much transparency as possible, that these companies, for instance, these CEOs, that we know exactly what they're getting paid, what their bonuses are, what their compensation plans are, and that they report them truthfully. And then I think a good government should enforce these the laws on the books, rules that are in place to go after people who are really taking egregious advantage of the market. We had an SEC under the Bush administration that tended to ignore problems when times were good. I think we all have a natural tendency to want to ignore the potential problems in our economy or our system when times are good. But they seem to be especially good at it, and I think part of the problem, part of this whole Ponzi scheme that Bernie Madoff got away with for 15 years was a result. Of course, obviously, this wasn't the SEC's fault that he created this Ponzi scheme, but they had plenty of warnings that this guy, you know, what he was doing just wasn't above the table. And if you're going to ignore things like that, then you're not doing any of us any good. So I see that as a potential failure. I think there are other things that could be done, simple things, you know, having a centralized market for over-the-counter derivatives, a central clearinghouse for things like credit default swaps would prevent sort of stunning breakdown in the markets we saw last fall. But I would counsel that we take a measured approach to looking at regulation going forward. Anything that I've heard from President Obama seems to suggest that he wants to do that. But oftentimes, Congress, again, in wanting to point fingers and blame others, will push something through fast just because they think it sounds good. And I would be worried about that.
All right, Ed. Thanks, man.
Thanks.
All right, 11:55 on the wake-up call. Just a few minutes left. with Professor Smith here in the studio today. This is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. Professor, you know, everything today so far has been about the United States. And I think one of the things that worries people is that this has spread and spread very quickly. France, in my understanding, is now giving money to their automobile industry. England has spent a lot of effort and money for their banking system. How does that play a role in the United States attempting to start the lift back up and improving things?
Well, one thing it means is we can't rely on the other countries to buy our goods as a way of getting out of our doldrums. On the other hand, there is a somewhat perverted good news to that. One of the big concerns that we have in both in our for our financial markets and for the way we run our fiscal policies, we borrow an awful lot of money from abroad to finance both our government expenditures and just our investments in general. And there's always a concern that if the rest of the world loses confidence in the U.S., they'll just pull out all that money, and that will raise interest rates, create more havoc in our financial markets. And the one thing we can say is that if the rest of the world is struggling, in some ways struggling more than us, in relative terms, we're still the place to keep our investments. So it is kind of funny, you know, there's this saying that whenever the U.S. sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. And I think we're seeing that right now. And I don't think we could count on foreign demand to get us out of this, get the recovery going. It really has to be domestically driven anyway. So in some weird way, the fact that other countries are doing poorly, including sort of our developed, particularly our peers in the industrialized world, is good news for us.
All right, just a few moments left. I can probably take one more call if somebody wants to dial up, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Professor, you know, I guess one of the big concerns that we chatted about very briefly before we came on is all this money supposedly being distributed in some fashion, shovel-ready programs. And the concern is that from a lot of us is that the people who are going to be shovel-ready are the people who are always there with their hand out, not necessarily using the money to the efficient extent that the hope is for.
Right, and so this is what worries me too. I mean, this is for the spending part of the stimulus package. You know, we're looking at $365 billion the government's going to spend. The hope with the Obama administration is to spend like half of that within the first 18 months of the administration just as a way to get the economy started. Now, there's no doubt to me that we could use some government spending or use some spending. I don't know if it needs to be government spending on things like infrastructure, roads, bridges, highways, and so forth, and other infrastructure projects like a better system of distribution of electricity across the country. We have this antiquated system that when other parts of the electrical market are developing quickly, this sort of acts as a bottleneck. So on the one hand, I think it'd be great to spend money in these areas, other energy area projects and so forth. If we're going to spend it really fast, I mean, I it's hard for me to understand how that can be spent wisely. And like you say, Rick, there's going to be lots of people ready, shovel ready to ask for that money. And my sense from experience and just how governments work is you spend that money out and not that much, not all that, every dollar the government spends, you know, a fraction of that dollar is actually going to go to creating jobs. The rest is going to go towards lining somebody else's pocket or building some silly thing that we don't really need, some fishery in the middle of Indiana or something like that. Not to pick on Indiana or fisheries, but I think we need to be really cautious as citizens, as taxpayers, to make sure that money, as it goes out the door, you know, doesn't end up in wasted.
All right. Time to finish up. Professor, thank you so much for being a guest today.
Thank you.
And I'm going to invite you back. You're now my regular business guest.
Okay.
By the way, if you didn't hear the whole show, www.seavillepodcast.com. We'll be back next week with conversation about libraries, an event that's coming on in Charlottesville, censorship, etc. All right. See you next Sunday.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The wake-up call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.